This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The Sister Cities program has been a political football in Bloomington of late, but committee chair Darren Sampson says it still has real value for Twin Cities culture.
It's about reaching out. It's about forming the bonds. It's about getting to know something outside of yourself and being part of something that's a bit bigger than yourself here in Central Illinois.
From post-war citizen diplomacy to today, Ryan Denham has more on the Sister Cities effort. There's a new scan available in the Twin Cities to help diagnose Alzheimer's disease. Colleen Reynolds has that story. And there's a teacher shortage across the nation and in Illinois. GLT's Charlie Schlenker talks with the people trying to fill it. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's August 23rd, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner is fighting an online battle with conservative critics over his spending on a recent trip to Japan. It's even led to a state police investigation. Caught in the middle is Bloomington Normal Sister Cities Committee, the group that organized the big 55th anniversary trip to Japan, and the more frequent student exchanges. GLT's Ryan Denham talks with Bloomington Normal Sister Cities Committee Chair Darren Sampson about seeing his organization caught up in the story.
I haven't been interpreting what's been going on as negative for the Sister Cities Committee and the mission that it's trying to accomplish with our charge as a committee. Yes, we are funded by the City of Bloomington and the Town of Normal, and yes, our mayors were part of our 55th anniversary celebration. Publicity is good, not necessarily all publicity, but if I can lend any clarity to what's been in the news or conversations about what we were doing over there, that's what I'm here to help out with.
I mean, has it been a little bit frustrating to see some of what's been reported and talked about?
Yes, because while we were in Japan celebrating with our sister city, we're getting emails or texts saying that there were inquiries being made about the trip, and so. Not wanting to distract or detract from the us being there and enjoying the trip, enjoying each other, experiencing this culture, and meeting with our friends across the ocean, we didn't really let it get to us while we were there because, we'll eventually return and we can help answer any questions that anybody has. So. For an hour or so, our coordinator on the committee and I talked a little bit about it, and we agreed that we weren't going to have any ability to take care of things there. So we said we'd obviously address it when we got back. So we did so and continued to enjoy why we were there in the first place.
So tell me about the trip, this 55th anniversary trip you were on. So what was it like? What kinds of things were you doing there?
It was amazing. We had a wonderful group of not only committee members and many spouses. I brought my wife, Michelle, and my children, Brett and Holly, for their first visit as well. And then, of course, committee members and their spouses. And then we had a number of citizens from Bloomington Normal and surrounding communities who wanted to join us as well to go over and experience the culture, eat the food, and just be part of this amazing celebration of 55 years of Sister Cities friendship between us and Asahikawa, Japan. So
5 years ago, for the 50th anniversary, I believe folks from Japan actually came here, and then this time we are going there for the 55th.
Correct.
So how many people went on this trip?
So in total, we had about 32 that were part of the official delegation and citizens delegation that partook. And some of us paid additional monies to tour other parts of Japan ahead of the celebration because when you travel for 13 hours on a flight, you kind of want to get as much as you can get in. And so a lot of us chose to extend the trip ahead of time. And then we all paid for that touring in Kyoto and Tokyo and Nara and Sapporo and other places that were outside of our anniversary trip.
So for those who've never heard of it, or maybe just heard about it in passing, mm-hmm. what is the Sister Cities program?
Eisenhower, back in before I was born, was promoting people-to-people relationships between us and other countries worldwide. And they charged cities across America to complete an application and basically distribute that to potential folks across the world who may be interested in forming that sister city relationship. They called it citizen diplomacy. And so, as it turns out, the mayor of Bloomington at the time had filled out an application and had sent it to Asaikawa, who, relatively speaking, is a small town of 350,000, but they're very comparable in sort of how it feels to be there versus how it feels to be here in town. And then a teacher, Mayor Judy, later to be Mayor Judy Markowitz, happened to be in Japan and then went to meet with Asaikawa and its leaders at the time. And they struck off a wonderful friendship, and then we formalized the relationship just a short couple of years later. And so that's the start of the exchange program, and the primary piece being the student exchange for high school students.
Yeah, so talk about that student exchange. Who comes here? Who goes there?
Yeah, so every year, Japan and the United States here in Illinois, we send one student to the other's city to study for 10 months. Back in the day when I was selected as the exchange student for representing Normal, we stayed a full year, but due to visa changes over the years, we're limited now to about 10 months worth of stay. But each year, we select a student on a student scholarship to be the student ambassador and go to high school in the other city. So Japan sends one student, we send one. And so recently, we just sort of dropped off Mitchell, who is a student from Normal in Japan to study for 10 months. And now we have Minami from Asaikawa studying here at Bloomington High School for the next 10 months as well.
This is GLT's Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. I'm here with Darren Sampson, chair of the Bloomington Normal Sister Cities Committee. So, Darren, this program is 55 years old now, this relationship at least. So I think some of the criticism of the program, or at least with what's going on recently, has focused on, you know, we no longer have a Japanese automaker in town. So that connection is broken. This thing is so old. I mean, so why is a program, Darren, like this still a benefit to our community in the year 2017?
Sure. You know, and that's a great question. And right about the time I was returning as the high school student from my year abroad, it was a short year later when Mitsubishi Motors decided to set up shop here in Normal. We felt as a committee, or the committee at the time felt, that that relationship that we had established for many, many years ahead of that was a primary reason that they ultimately pulled the trigger to locate here. We had people who were interested in being part of the lives and having the friendships with those across the sea, in Japan specifically, had an interest in the culture, had an interest in sharing our culture with them. And so as far as a sort of a mutually beneficial arrangement, I think we helped that decision-making process. I feel very comfortable that had we not had that established programming, Mitsubishi would have never maybe made it to this Central Illinois location over other locations that were being considered at the time. But it's about reaching out. It's about forming the bonds. It's about getting to know something outside of yourself and being part of something that's a bit bigger than yourself here in Central Illinois. And so it could have been Canterbury, England, or Vladimir, Russia, or Asaikawa, Japan, but it's outside our comfort zone, and it's taken a lot of years to develop those relationships and keep these strong programs running. So, the interest is there for those in the community who want to be part of that. There's plenty of volunteer opportunities on the committee. There's opportunities for students at from seventh grade all the way through high school to be able to be part of that exchange program, whether it's in the junior ambassador capacity for a short-term two-week visit, or whether it's applying for the scholarship for the 10-month program. So we feel that broadening those minds, especially of our students, is key in allowing them to think more globally than locally, and to be aware of not being the same as others, and then having that recognition and understanding that there are things out there that, you know, maybe I should pay attention to, listen to, observe, and maybe incorporate into my own behaviors or my own understanding of other cultures and those who may be different from us. So programs like these are the grassroots, they're sort of the grassroots ability for you to take action on a very small plane that may have rippling effects to wider community and state and potentially country. So these are the folks we would want to see, you know, leading our governments and leading our corporations in that broad-mindedness. So that's, I don't want to get on a soapbox, but that's really where it starts. It starts at home. It starts with these small programs that allow people to invest in themselves, and then hopefully they receive just as much out of it that they've been putting into it.
So this recent 55th anniversary trip to Japan, I think you said about 32 people was in our delegation going there. So my understanding is that Sister Cities generally is funded in part by private donations and a combination of City and Bloomington and Town of Normal funds.
Correct.
So for a trip like that 55th anniversary trip, so who pays for individuals to make that trip?
All the individuals who were participating contributed to their own trip. It was privately funded for the majority of those who attended. As was customary, the mayor of Bloomington and the mayor of Normal, of course, would have theirs as part of the official delegation. The city and town would be funding those bills. I, as the representative of the chair of the Sister Cities Committee, I had just my flight covered, but all my personal travel outside of the official travel to Japan for this event was all covered personally. So I had to pay for my wife, my children, and we saved up quite a few months to do that. But everybody who participated, including committee members, all paid for their own trips.
Yeah, so this doesn't sound like some kind of taxpayer-funded junket. This is private money paying for private individuals to go on this trip.
Yeah, for most of us, that saving had been over quite a few months because it's not cheap, but we had an amazing experience, and it's a once-in-a-lifetime. That's how we, as our family, considered it to be a sort of, I know it's expensive, and we're going to look back on it as an amazing experience, but it's worth it. It was worth the hardship to save up for that. So
gotcha.
Happy we did it.
So Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner's partner, Margot Ehrlich, was on the trip. She was. He says that she was an official delegate for that trip. She's a music educator here in town. Mm-hmm. So I guess, first of all, is that true? Was she really part of the official delegation? And then secondly, what type of people are actually part of the official delegation? Like what occupations are they in, and what kind of organizations do they represent?
Sure. No. Fair question. And can easily answer it for you. As part of our committee responsibilities and help sort of set up our group going there and working with the Japan committee and their government to make sure they understood who's coming and what capacity, it had to be very clear who was part of the official delegation versus the citizen delegation. Both mayors are official delegates. Any guests that they would have are part of the official delegation. So I and all of my committee members on the Sister City Committee were all official delegates, as well as our spouse or our guest that we were bringing with us. Japan had needed this definition around our trip because only official delegates were being hosted at the hotel in Asahikawa by the Asahikawa city. And all the other participants, all the citizen delegation folks, were being matched up with host families so they could have the full experience of that sort of cross-cultural sharing and understanding. And so by all means, both mayors and Ms. Ehrlich were part of the official delegation. And that was communicated by us to Asahikawa, and that's exactly how it played out. So our group, the official delegation and the citizen delegation, toured around different parts of Asahikawa. You know, the city provided a bus, and then we got to see schools, museums, the zoo, other things that they were so proud of within Asahikawa City. And so at each location, we all sort of represented Bloomington Normal, some as official delegates and some as citizen delegates. But we were all expected to be there, and the participation of our group, whether official or citizen delegation, was amazing. It was amazing to see them just eat it up, you know, because I had the opportunity to observe the group as we went around to different places, and it couldn't have gone off better, honestly.
What's the message you want to leave people with here as we wrap up, people who maybe heard the sister city's name in the news the last few weeks, any kind of closing thoughts you want to leave with them?
Get involved. There is a place for you within a program like this. It doesn't have to be at the committee level where you're doing the behind-the-scenes work that supports, because we have an amazing group of volunteers who commit their time and energy to this committee and their hearts as well. And we love them because they understand it, they get it, they get our mission. We have other opportunities for participation, whether it's as a host family who takes a student for maybe a week when their delegation of junior high students come for 1 week around spring break time. So acting as a host family, getting that exposure and experience on a short-term basis, and maybe getting their whistle wet for maybe hosting a longer high school student. Of course, the high school students, we typically like to see those host families for 3-4 months at a time. So there's some continuity for the student as well as for the family that they're living with. And then just participating. If we have events out there, come out and see it. I mean, last fall we did an event over at Metcalf where we were pounding rice in a traditional way for, sort of a Japanese treat. And it was just sort of an introduction to the culture, and we got community members and students out. So, you know, check our website out, bnsistercities.org. Follow us on Facebook. We have a wonderful committee Facebook page, and we constantly are advertising events and things that we're being part of to raise awareness and to get people excited about being part of this culture, this exchange, and this what has turned out for me to be lifelong friendships with folks across the ocean. So for me, coming back to Japan this summer after 32 years was amazing. And that was not possible without this program. That connection to those folks would never have taken place without something like this. And, I have people over there that I call mom and dad and my brother as a result of this. And to see them after all these years was just absolutely outstanding.
That's Darren Sampson, chairman of the Bloomington Normal Sister Cities Committee. I'm Ryan Denham.
Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner denies any wrongdoing related to the trip. He says he looks forward to a quick resolution to the state police investigation. It's Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for GLT comes from Justin M. Boyd, Country Financial Representative, building relationships while supporting and serving the community. Justin offers life insurance options designed to protect your family and leave a lasting legacy. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. Coming up, it's an edition of Grow with tips on moving plants. That's still to come during Sound Ideas. Here on GLT, I'm Mike McCurdy. There is a teacher shortage, and it's not just in Illinois. Teaching candidate enrollment nationwide was about 691,000 in 2009. It dropped to 451,000 in 2014. That's a 35% drop, according to a study called The Coming Crisis in Teaching, Teacher Supply, and the Coming Crisis in Education. Nancy Latham is an early childhood education professor and the ISU representative to the State Board of Education. Maureen Smith is director of recruitment and enrollment in the College of Education at Illinois State University. And Deb Garahey is the director of the Lobby Teacher Education Center at ISU. They talk with GLT's Charlie Schlenker about the reasons for the drop, declining numbers of high school graduates, and people afraid to go into the profession because of the state pension issue and other uncertainties. There are other reasons, too, changing family dynamics and teachers having to take up more of a social worker role. Maureen Smith says the decline is clear nationwide and in ISU enrollment trends.
I'm finding a lot of young people who have seen teaching from just their perspective. They've only seen it as a point of view as a student. So the first thing we try to have them do is to go out and observe with other people and other grade levels to really get an appreciation of the complexity of being a teacher. Once they've kind of done that, then they're better suited to be able to go into an educational field. A lot of people go into teaching thinking it's going to be a 9-month job. And so we want to make sure up front that they have an understanding of what's going to be expected of them. The trends I'm seeing are not unlike what I've seen before. We're having shortage areas that we cannot fill, special ed, math, science. And we find that a lot of people are still heading into the younger grades, which are desperately needed now also. But trying to get enough to fill our schools is becoming increasingly difficult.
And this is in spite of ISU having a pretty good reputation as an educator production center.
Yes, that's true. We are one of the leading producers of education majors in the country, let alone the state. And though we do draw from many states away for people to come to our programs, we still have to work very actively to get the numbers that we are comfortable with at our institution.
Nancy, this probably should go to you. You're the ISU representative to the Illinois State Board of Education. How do you see the major shortages unfolding going forward in Illinois? Obviously, rural areas, mm-hmm. urban areas with high minority and poverty concentrations. Maureen already mentioned STEM mm-hmm. as a shortage. Where are the highest needs?
I actually looked at some statistics last night off of open positions in Illinois, and right as of last night, there were 2,000 open positions. Around 1,300 of those were instructional positions, and they weren't anything surprising, just as you just said. They were math, science, special education were the highest areas. About 25% of all the openings really fall within the Cook County, DuPage, Kankakee, Will, so that four-county area up there made up 25% of those. A couple of Peoria, I think, had 91 open. Peoria County had 91 open positions as well. So, I mean, I don't think the trends in Illinois are in any way different or patterning any differently than what we're seeing nationally. They are math, science. They are special education.
And this is even though Illinois has a higher than national average starting pay.
And part of that, I think, is when you do have a large or a couple of large urban areas in your mm-hmm. state, like if you are, Chicago, Atlanta, L.A., New York, those are going to skew that starting pay mm-hmm. just a little bit, that starting pay figure. But I think we have always examined, we always look at teacher supply and demand. We think of it as a bucket, and we're constantly pouring into the bucket, but the bucket has holes in the bottom. And what we need to research more and more all the time is not only what we're pouring into the bucket and how we're pouring it in, which is ISU's preparing teachers, but it also is what is creating those holes in the bottom of the bucket. And Deb alluded to a lot of those, what creates those holes, but it really has shifted, and where teachers go when they leave the field, when they move around the field, where are they going? All of those kinds of things.
Deb Garahey, you're the director of the Lauby Teacher Education Center. What are the holes in the bucket? Is it teacher attrition? Is it retirements? Is it people not going into it anymore?
I think it's all of the above. I really think it's all of the above. And I think that these conversations are cyclical. I'm now starting my 31st year in education, my 19th year in teacher education at ISU. And some of the conversations you hear on the media are conversations that happened in 1984, 1985, when I was graduating from my undergraduate program.
And then again in 1990, there was another shortage bump.
Correct. But I think that if you connect the dots, they're very similar conversations. In the past, the longevity of somebody who became a teacher was pretty much there. They would probably be a teacher, maybe not necessarily in their district that they started out with, but they would remain in teaching. Again, I think it goes back to some of those conversations, the typical pay scale that a teacher receives for a 9-month position. Going back to what either Maureen or Nancy said, teaching is not a 9-month position. Teachers do things on their own, out of their pocket, because it's what's needed for the student to be successful. Teachers use a summer for professional development, for their own education. And those are the things that the general public does not realize. It must be nice to have the summer off. As a public school teacher, I didn't have the summer off. I chose to supplement my salary by working for the school district, and I think many teachers do. Or they use that time to reboot. You need to reboot.
Yeah. Well, let's cycle back to the idea of the circular nature of this, the mm-hmm. waves that, mm-hmm. that you remarked over the course of your career. Why do we not have more even distribution of age cohorts of educators?
I think because the nature of teaching changes, the audience changes. Any suggestion, other additions here? It is really true that children are children and students are students, but there's just so many different variables that you can never prepare a teacher for. The internet and Facebook and social media did not exist when I was a public school teacher, but that is something that everybody deals with now. We all dealt with bullying and how you handle classroom bullies, but handling bullying now would be a very, very different species, considering that it's not done face-to-face. Mm-hmm. So I think that those things change.
It's a very change. Yeah, I agree. It's changing. I mean, when I started teaching, they prepared us with what to do for a fire drill and a tornado drill, and now it's an active shooter drill.
That's right.
I think it's just, and all professions change. I understand that, but in some ways, the field has stayed exactly very stagnant as far as maybe its pay, its prestige, its benefits, how it's thought of. But it has shifted mm-hmm. in what's demanded of teaching.
The look of teaching still looks the same.
But
you have an individual in a classroom with X amount of students. But what goes on in that classroom, what goes on in the school, what goes on in the district, what goes on in the community is changed.
So you're raising the possibility that the technological shifts have encouraged waves of retirement at certain eras because people don't want to retool after a certain point in their career. Maureen, that one's yours.
There is an element of truth to that because as I talk with a lot of my peers, as I've been in higher education for almost 40 years, when I talk with my peers, as things were not good at maybe the state level, and there was a lot of discussion about how the retirements were going to be shifted and payouts and things like that, everybody that was pretty much healthy, they said, I'm going to hang around for a while to see what happens. Well, what happens is when a teacher who is generating a high income for longevity in a classroom, if they're not retiring, suddenly the school district can't hire new teachers. So I would say there is a cyclical pattern. A lot of it is brought on by external factors. People just don't retire at certain points. When the crash came in 08, or not really a crash, but when we had the down in 08, there was a lot of people not retiring anymore. And so that did cause...
And there were some layoffs, too.
And there were.
And that caused people to come back and alleviated a shortage, at least for a few years.
That's right. So there are external factors that cause this ebb and flow of hiring and retirement.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Deb Garahey, director of the Laube Teacher Education Center, Maureen Smith, head of recruitment and enrollment in the College of Education, and Nancy Latham, an early childhood education professor and the ISU representative to the Illinois State Board of Education. Nancy, you had mentioned that teacher pay in some parts of the state, urban areas, has to be higher to attract people. But the average is skewed lower in other parts of the state. How then do you get teachers to maybe go against their economic interest and go where they're needed rather than where they can get a job?
I think ISU, showing my bias here, but ISU, I think, does a wonderful job of that. It's taken years for them to build the partnerships that ISU has built to do that. And one huge priority here at ISU is looking at providing students with diverse experiences, and especially asking students to look, what is a diverse experience for you? Mm-hmm. If you came from a very rural, small district kind of environment, let's set up the pipeline and figure out ways to get you into urban environments, different socioeconomic levels, et cetera, because it's all about getting you comfortable and getting you feeling like you are you can have an impact in an environment that maybe is not where you would be where you're the most comfortable, because it's most like yours.
Deb, you have a thought.
In fact, the Council for Teacher Education at Illinois State University, which is made up of faculty and students and administration from teacher education, years ago implemented diverse field hours placement. So all of our teacher candidates at ISU, and currently we're about 3,600 undergraduate teacher candidates, are required to complete at minimum 100 pre-student teaching hours. So before they ever get into their student teaching site, they have to have at least a minimum of 100 hours out in a school setting, agency setting, observing, teaching, assisting, and 50 of those hours must be in a diverse setting. So all of our programs, and we have 28 undergraduate programs, are all doing this on behalf of our students to give them an idea of classrooms that perhaps were different than the ones they attended as a K through 12 student.
And what is your outcome? Do people then adopt those classrooms and say, this is where I want to work? Or do they say, no, I came from rural, I'm going back to rural?
I think a lot of it is still determined on where a person grew up. Because many of our student teachers, for financial reasons, have to go home to student teach as best as possible. We try to accommodate that in an appropriate setting. I do think that whether or not they end up in a similar district that they grew up in or a very different district, having that different perspective is just as important as where they end up teaching, because where they start off does not mean that's where they're going to finish. I started off student teaching in New York City, and I ended up teaching, I was a licensed teacher in Ohio, very different than the area that I grew up in. So I think it's
what are teacher mobility rates then? I mean, we talk about student velocity as a barrier academic achievement, but how about the teachers? How much do they cycle in and out of a given district?
I don't have exact numbers for the state of Illinois, but I do know that mobility is something that happens, especially early in a person's career, because in the first few years as they're getting the district that they want, or maybe the grade level that they want, you might see them float amongst different institutions or districts. But then after a certain point, as they start getting settled in, getting married, buying a house, whatever, then that's generally where they stay. But not knowing how they do it, you know, the first 5 years of teaching, I can tell you that Illinois State University graduates, that we teach in all 50 states and in over 56 countries. So we do have a very highly mobile alumni base that are in the field of education. And when students are talking to me about the major that they're looking for, every conversation starts or ends with, well, if I want to leave the state of Illinois, or if I want to go to this area, what do I need to do? So they are thinking about those things. I'm finding it more now than I've had, I'd say, within the last 10 years, those conversations were not taking place.
Deb, I interrupted you. Did you need to complete a thought? Okay. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking about supplying the number of needed teachers, several hundred thousand a year nationwide, with a shortage projected at least for the next few years. The elephant in the room here is teacher attrition, people leaving the profession. In fact, according to some studies, about 95% of the shortage is caused by the attrition part, people getting out of the career. How do you try to maximize the chance of that it will take as a career?
Well, I think, there really was a shift a few years ago. It's been more than a few years ago now, but there was a shift in the way we thought about making and creating new teachers, and that was that we realized it's been probably 15, 20 years ago when the professional development school movement started. We realized that schools had to partner with us in making the next generation of great teachers as much as we had to partner with schools, that was a dual role. And I think as far as keeping teachers in the field, induction and mentoring is the exact same thing. Another thing that we're doing here at ISU is trying to support our new teachers when they're out there in the field. We have an annual new teacher conference where we bring any graduates back for a free day of PD and networking and try to remain in contact with them in their first, second, third, even fourth year. They can come back for that. We try to keep those relationships. We're doing a lot of things too, and I think it's part because schools just don't have the money that they may have had at one time, and that's another thing when you talk about the pay differential. There's a huge differential in induction and mentoring programs in districts. Some have districts that you're assigned a coach the minute you get there, and you have all these benefits in this incredible program, and other districts, they may have absolutely nothing to do that they can do in the name of induction and mentoring, really. And so Teacher Ed is partnering more and more.
Have those programs been around long enough to move the needle on retention, teacher retention?
I think, I don't know what the exact figures of induction and mentoring, the impact of those would be, but I do know that when teachers report the reasons they leave the field, you would think one of the top reasons would be pay, and it's not. One of the top reasons is non-supportive administration. And so I think if you were being supported through your administration through an induction and mentoring program, that might not be, because the top reasons teachers really
job
seem to give.
Job dissatisfaction.
Job dissatisfaction, which comes down to shifting mandates, even changing parental demands, again, non-supportive administration. Those are the top reasons they give for leaving the field, not there are some typical sound bites thrown out there a lot that they leave for the money and that the brightest leave. And all of the research that we've seen, and we have a huge study here at ISU where we've followed our teacher education majors. We have about 8,000 of them in the study over a 15-year period, looking at where they go and where they stick and what other fields, if they leave teaching, where do they go? We really are seeing, now I will say we are seeing a little bit of a decline in the attrition rate. If you really look at it over 15 years, it's maybe the hole in the bottom of the bucket is not quite, we're not quite at that 50% that's always soundbited.
Scale that for our listeners, would you? How much lower?
Well, I'm trying to think. The last analysis we did of that, I think we were at about 45% still within the field and we're still analyzing that data because we really want to look at it this time to see if they leave, where do they go, and how often are they shifting? Because typically the attrition data looks at that as stayers, leavers, and movers. So movers are moving within districts, within schools, and shifting positions. And then, of course, leavers are leaving the field. So where are they going when they leave?
Nancy Latham is an early childhood education professor and the ISU representative to the State Board of Education. Maureen Smith is director of recruitment and enrollment in the College of Education at ISU. And Deb Garahy is the director of the Lobby Teacher Education Center at Illinois State University. They spoke with GLT's Charlie Schlenker on Sound Ideas. The Blue Aces reunite for a benefit show at the Castle Theater on Sunday. Tomorrow, GLT's John Norton talks with Steve the Heart Melberg and George Boyle about the band who played around Central Illinois from 1998 to 2003. You're listening to The Blue Aces. The blues is all right.
Oh, the blues is all right when there's someone left to play the game. Now my friends have gone and left me. Things just ain't the same. I was born in Chicago. Born in Chicago. My friends up there are gone and left me. Things ain't the same. Come on, Steve. Oh,
The Blues Is All Right. The Blue Aces, Steve the Hart Melberg, George Boyle, Billy Gault, and Al Chapman reunite for a show at the Castle Theater on Sunday. John Norton has the interview tomorrow during Sound Ideas.
Wait for it. Wait for it. Wait for it. No, seriously, you gotta wait for the Sweet Corn Blues Festival. The corn isn't finished growing yet, but when it's done, be sure and visit your GLT pals at the Sweet Corn Blues Festival, August 26th and 27th. There's live music, fresh sweet corn, and it's all in Uptown Normal. Find more info at WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from Jack Baytall Real Estate Group at Keller Williams. Jack and his team are committed to helping Bloomington Normal continue to thrive by giving back to GLT and other local nonprofits. Current listings at jacksguarantee.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Fall is a great time to get a move on, moving your plants around. Patrick Murphy has more on this edition of GLT's Grow.
As we approach fall, so we approach the season for transplanting. I'm Laura Kennedy, and this is GLT's Grow, your source for practical gardening advice from our expert in the field from the Illinois State University School of Biological Sciences and curator of the Fell Arboretum. It's Patrick Murphy. Hello, Murph.
Hi, Laura.
Today on GLT's Grow, it's transplanting 101. We're talking shrubs and trees, not like huge trees, obviously, but reasonably.
Unless you got a tree spade park in the garage on the compound, you know, some families have those.
Well, we had a tree spade on the
you
compound.
You are Kennedy, after all.
Absolutely. Yeah. But so transplanting, this is what we want to be getting ready for.
It is a great time to start making plans. As many of the things we do in the garden, the plan is the really important thing. Mm-hmm. And a plan would include what you're going to move. So are you moving some herbaceous perennials? Are you moving some shrubs? Are you moving some trees? Because if you are, there's a time for those to be moved. Most of what we have in our garden in the Midwest, we can move it in the fall.
Uh-huh.
But there are some things that are just best to do in the spring. And a lot of those things are from the flowering shrubs and trees that we see in the spring. So if you want to move a rhododendron in your yard or an azalea or a magnolia, all of which are those early spring winters that just really make spring feel welcome, You want to wait till the spring on those. But
Do we wait till they're done blooming to do that?
Absolutely, Laura. Okay. Thank you for bringing that point up. That's right. Let them have the energy of producing a flower and a seed.
And then when they're exhausted and go, oh, I can't do anymore, please transplant me. That's when we do it.
You could do it before that.
Oh, okay.
You could also do it before that.
All righty.
So, but for everything else, there's a scenario and a story for everything, and I see many of us gardeners gazing upon our yard day after day. You mow and you see the same stuff, and you sometimes play this little game in your mind where you think, geez, you know, if this plant was 2 feet over, I could make a turnaround right here as I'm taking care of my turf.
Yeah.
Or these little dwarf rhododendrons that I bought at a Shopko retail yard outside of town, they look great for 2 years, but man, I've been fighting and fighting and fighting with them, and I could get rid of them and put them in another spot in my yard and replace them with some stuff that's crowded that's mm-hmm. also in my yard.
Okay.
So for the herbaceous perennials, like you got some hostas that you need to either divide or to move because they're too crowded. One thing I'd like you to consider doing is putting a little stake or a ribbon or something so you can keep track of which one you're going to work on.
Right.
Because you're going to do this after the leaves are down and the perennial has declined for the season, right? And that's when the leaves are laying on the ground. So now your tell is gone. So if you have a stake there, or better yet, if you have a picture mm-hmm. or some kind of gardening journal, really, really proactive gardeners have gardening journals.
You're listening to GLT's Grow, our weekly gardening show for those who like to get their hands dirty. This week, the lowdown on transplanting trees and shrubs. And, you know, once I was trying to transplant a small shrub, and I got that thing, I got it all dug up, and then I went, oops, and I realized I didn't have the hole ready for where I was going to be putting it. So do we start with digging the hole that we're going to be putting the plant in? Is that step one?
That is a good practice, but there's one thing that we can do before that. So let's talk about, we do have some plants in our, we have some woody plants, right? Mm-hmm. We've got an arborvita that we need to move. So I'm going to go out now and I'm going to lance the ground in the area or in the perimeter where my root ball will be. I'm going to cut the roots now.
All right.
But I'm going to leave this arborvitae in the ground. And I'm going to leave it there until, again, later this fall when all the perennials have declined and their leaves are laying on the ground. And we've been watching football and chasing leaves. So that's when I'm going to move it out of this hole, which I've already lanced the roots.
Right.
And then it's important to have the new hole prepared.
Yes.
That's right. That is a huge thing. And preparing the hole for our herbaceous perennials, shrubs, and trees, we know to help establish new root growth that the size and the shape of the hole is important.
Oh.
So we want this big vase-shaped hole, mm-hmm. not a bucket-shaped hole, but something that's wider at the top and maybe a little narrower at the bottom.
Sort of V-ish?
Yes. V okay. with a flat bottom.
Yeah, I remember being at the cancer center with you. We were planting some trees last fall, and
yes.
and that was a great lesson.
That was a great exercise because we planted a whole bunch of 12-gallon potted trees.
Mm-hmm.
So the top of the pot was about 2 feet across. But when we finished carving our hole out, the hole was almost 4 feet wide at its widest point at the top. Also, that soil at the top of the edges of the hole is the good soil.
Right.
So you can actually make the hole wider after you've set the root ball down in it and break away that edges of that soil to make the hole wider
mm-hmm.
and let that same soil fall into the bottom of the planting hole. Another great practice is to fill that hole up with water and let it completely absorb before you complete backfilling. So what you're doing there is you're charging all those pores with water. That way, when you do your ongoing watering, the dry pores outside your new planting site aren't just wicking the moisture away from the roots before they have a chance to take it up. This is a great practice. Watering is the key on new plantings, and it certainly is critical in transplanting. We also can help those roots develop by covering the soil at the surface with mulch to help regulate the temperature and also to maintain a consistency of moisture. So the mulch will kind of hold in moisture that's there and actually help create a little bit of moisture on a hot, sunny day because it's insulating that ground. You can sometimes get a little bit of condensation below your mulch
because
mulch is breaking down over soil that's sometimes a little cooler.
Mm-hmm.
So there's kind of a cyclical event there. One thing you want to be real conservative on when you transplant is pruning.
Mm-hmm.
So more important when it comes to shrubs and woody shrubs and trees, pruning should be limited to branches that were damaged right before or during the transplanting. You want to have as much leaf surface as you can conducting photosynthesis and growing to help those new roots get going.
Right.
And that has changed in my lifetime. I can remember when I got started in this field, there was a common practice of pruning away some of the lower branches on newly planted trees.
Mm-hmm.
I just can't think of a worse thing to do now,
wow.
knowing what we do know. When it comes to transplanting trees, we oftentimes have to use some kind of staking. Two or three stakes is typically best. And you definitely want one stake holding the tree so that it can stand against the prevailing winds, which are north by northwest.
Oh, that's a great movie.
Yes, it is. And the stakes are not going to help keep the tree straight. You want it straight when you plant it.
Okay.
The stakes are going to maintain straightness, and there doesn't need to be a bunch of tension on there. We just need something to help the top part of the tree, the above ground parts,
mm-hmm.
holding still so that we don't disturb those young fibrous roots that are going to get started during the cooler soil temperatures. And that's why fall is a great time for transplanting. So the same reason our grass grows a lot more in the fall and our yards look fantastic in the fall, because the weeds are going away and the growing temperatures for the grass are great because of cool soil temperatures. That's also going to be the thing that gives us the touchdown, go birds, for our transplanting operation.
Okay, great advice, Murph. And now we've got time to make a plan before you do any transplanting. Now, coming up next week on GLT's Grow, we've got a question from Peter in Lexington about planting windscreen trees. Do you have a question or a problem you'd like Murph to take on? Go to our website, wglt.org/grow, fill in the form, and you'll send that along to us, and it's possible that Murph will pick your question to answer on the air. Send a photo as well. We'd love to see your problem. Submit at wglt.org/grow.
You can download the Grow podcast weekly at iTunes or at wglt.org. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Our website, wglt.org, is where you can find the Sound Ideas podcast and the individual interviews and stories you heard today, thanks to Charlie Schlenker, Ryan Denham, and Laura Kennedy. Let us know what you think of Sound Ideas by sharing your thoughts at facebook.com/WGLTFM or tweet about the show. Use the hashtag Sound Ideas. I'm at Mike McCurdy. We're all at WGLT News. This is 89.1 FM GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.